Thank you, John, and thank you for all that you've done and the library has done to support creative writing events here at VCU. It's very important support. In writing a poem, what is the role of the personal life versus the larger cultural and historical aspects of a poet's knowledge? In an era when identity politics seems to dominate the national conversation, not only on the internet but in the news, when many poets are involved with what a recent article called a new movement in American poetry, the poetry of social engagement, can there be an aesthetic balance point between the merely personal and a cultural perspective that might stand outside of time? The great Irish poet William Butler Yeats, who was clearly a significant influence on Larry Levis, believed that great poetry relied on the fully awakened tension between those two poles. On the one hand, Yeats asserted that a poet writes always out of his personal life, in his finest work, out of its tragedy, whatever it be, remorse, lost love, or mere loneliness. Yet in the same sentence, he went on to add that the poet never speaks directly as to someone at the breakfast table. There is always a phantasmagoria. For Yeats, that phantasmagoria is not only the imagined audience of readers addressed by the poet in his own time, but a much larger ghostly audience, which arises from many eras and occupies an extensive mythic landscape that crosses cultural and temporal boundaries. That larger consciousness is what Yeats called the spiritus mundi, or world spirit, which he defined as a universal memory and a muse of sorts that provides inspiration to the poet or writer. In his late great poem, Elegy with a Thimbleful of Water in the Cage, Larry Levis takes on the complex aesthetic task of balancing the personal and the mythic, of weaving them into a braided narrative that seeks out their entwined interdependence as he enacts a search for identity and connection while operating under the pressure of the ultimate erasure guaranteed by time. While it is an inescapable truth that all poets work in the shadow and under the influence of all the poets and poetries that have gone before them, two famous poems from the modernist era, in particular, may be identified as ancestor poems to the Levis poem. One is The Wasteland by T.S. Eliot, a poem that seeks to encompass all that ailed a modern society shattered by the enormous costs in human life on a scale previously unknown that not only resulted from the First World War, an unprecedented global conflict during 1914 to 1918, in which more than 9 million combatants and 7 million civilians died, but also the great flu epidemic, which followed on its heels in 1918, a plague which infected 500 million people across the world, resulting in an estimated 50 to 100 million deaths, thus killing 3 to 5% of the entire world's population, one of the deadliest natural disasters in human history. The destructive psychological effects of these cataclysms were explored in Eliot's Wasteland poem, which involved a hero quest and a ritual sacrifice. But despite the poem's attempt by Eliot to shore these fragments against my ruins, the poem concludes not with a healing, but instead with a sense of judgment and finality that called for transcendence rather than acting any sort of triumph. Eliot's poem begins rather darkly, with an epigraph taken from the Satyricon of Petronius, a Roman erotic satire about the misadventures of a former gladiator and his young male lover. The epigraph tells the story of the Sibyl, a woman whose loveliness attracted the attention of Apollo, who offered to grant her any wish, and although she asked to live for as many years as there were grains in a handful of dust, she forgot to ask for eternal youth. And so over the centuries she wasted away, until she was so tiny that she could be kept in a bird cage. The start of Eliot's poem includes the line, "I will show you fear in a handful of dust." It is no accident that Levis's own elegiac poem includes the story of the Sibyl of Cumae. Another poem that stands behind the Levis poem is Yeats's Dialogue of the Self and Soul, in which Yeats allows the soul to represent the transcendent, the eternal, the infinite, the visionary aspect, while the self stands for the earthy embrace of the cycles of time, the engagement with bodily existence and with natural forces of birth and decay. When Yeats described his own poem in a letter to a friend, he said that it is a choice of rebirth rather than deliverance from birth. and speaking as the self, to whom Yeats gives the longest and last word in his dialogue of the self and soul, he refuses to renounce his life and all the errors he has made, including the folly that man does or must suffer if he woos a proud woman not kindred of his soul. And he instead renounces remorse and thus experiences a great sweetness that allows the self ultimately to comprehend that everything we look on is blessed. While in the Yeats poem, then, the poet speaks as the self and refuses the Buddhist salvation of enlightenment, of freedom from the endless cycling of existence, and yet achieves a kind of sweetness in the acceptance of all the errors of the self, including errors of affection, the Levis poem may appear to be closer to the less clearly affirmative nature of The Wasteland by Eliot. But in fact, the Levis poem goes in two different directions at once, reaching toward a saving intimacy, even as it admits that the hope for connection, which the narrator might have held on to, nevertheless has probably receded into the irretrievable. And so the Levis poem leaves us in suspense between these two poles, between the saving possibility of profound and intimate human connection and the likelihood that we will all end in a profound isolation and searing alienation of the kind the Sibyl experienced, a place where nothing calls to you anymore, and you share her wish for a simple, total, and final escape. Here's Larry Levis's Elegy with a Thimbleful of Water in the Cage. It's a list of what I cannot touch. Some dandelions and black-eyed Susans growing back, like innocence itself with its thoughtless style, over an abandoned labor camp south of Piedra. And the oldest trees in that part of Paris with a name I forget, propped up with sticks to keep their limbs from cracking. And beneath such quiet, a woman with a cane, and knowing if I came back, I could not find them again. And a cat, I remember, who slept on the burnished mahogany in the scooped-out beveled place on the counter below the iron grillwork, the way you had to pass your letter over him as he slept through those warm afternoons in New Hampshire, the gray fur stirring a little as he inhaled, the small rural post office growing smaller, then lost, tucked into the shoreline of the lake when I looked back. Country music from a lone radio in an orchard there. The first frost already on the ground. And those who slipped out of their names, as if called out of them, as if they had been waiting to be called. Stavros, lecturing from his bequeathed chair at the Café Midi in the old Tower Theater District, his unending solo above the traffic on Olive, asking if we knew what happened to the Sibyl at Cumae after Ovid had told her story, after Petronius had swept the grains of sand from it, how, granted eternal life, she had forgotten to ask for youth, and so, as she kept aging, as her body shrank within itself and the centuries passed, she finally became so tiny they had to put her into a jar, at which point Petronius lost track of her, lost interest in her, and at which point she began to suffocate in the jar, suffocate without being able to die, until finally a Phoenician sailor slipped the gray piece of pottery, its hue like an overcast sky and revealing even less, into his pocket and sold it on the docks at Piraeus to a shop owner who, hearing her gasp, placed her in a birdcage on a side street just off Amnonius Square, not to possess her, but to protect her from pedestrians. And the boys of Athens rattled the bars of the cage with sticks as they ran past, yelling, "Sibyl, Sibyl, what do you want?" Each generation having to listen more closely than the one before to hear the faintest whispered rasp from the small bitter seed of her tongue as she answered them with the same remark passing through time, "I want to die." As time passed and she gradually grew invisible, the boys had to press their ears against the cage to hear her. And then one day the voice became too faint, no one could hear it, and after that they stopped telling the story. And then it wasn't a story. It was only an empty cage that hung outside a shop among the increasing noise of traffic. And from the square itself, blaring from loudspeakers, the shattered glass and bread of political speeches that went on half the night, and the intermittent music of strip shows in summer when the doors of the bars were left open. And then, Stavros said, the sun shone straight through the cage. You could see. There was nothing inside it, he said, unless you noticed how one of the little perches swung back and forth, almost imperceptibly there, though the street was hot, windless, or unless you thought you saw a trace of something flicker across the small mirror above the thimble full of water, which of course shouldn't have been there, which should have evaporated, like the voice that went on whispering ceaselessly its dry rage without listeners. He said that even if anyone heard it, they could not have recognized the dialect as anything human. He would lie awake, the only boy in Athens, who still heard it repeating its wish to die. And he was not surprised, he said, when the streets, the bars, and strip shows began to fill with German officers, or when the loudspeakers in the small platform in the square were one day shattered into 1,000 pieces. As the years passed, as even the sunlight began to seem as if it was listening to him outside the windows of the Midi, he began to lose interest in stories, and to speak only in abstractions, to speak only of theories, never of things. Then he began to come in less frequently, and when he did, he no longer spoke at all. And so, along the boulevards in winter, the bare limbs of the trees one passed in the city became again only the bare limbs of trees. No girl stepped into them to tell us of their stillness. We would hear rumors of Stavros following the gypsy Pentecostalists into their tents, accounts of him speaking in tongues, glossolalia, he once said, which was all speech and none. In a way, it didn't matter anymore. Something in time was fading. And though girls still came to the cafe to flirt or argue politics or buy drugs from the two ancient boys, expressionless as lizards, now as they bent above a chessboard, by summer, the city parks had grown dangerous. No one went there anymore to drink wine, dance, and listen to metal amplified until it seemed, as it had seemed once, the bitter cleansing angel released at last from what fettered it inside us. And maybe there wasn't any angel after all. The times had changed. It became difficult to tell for sure. And anyway, there was a law against it now. A law against gathering at night in the parks was actually all that the law said was forbidden for us to do, but it came to the same thing. It meant you were no longer permitted to know or to decide for yourself whether there was an angel inside you or whether there wasn't. Poverty is what happens at the end of any story, including this one, when there are too many stories. When you can believe in all of them and so believe in none. When one condition is as good as any other. The swirl of wood grain in the desk, is it the face of an angel? Or the photograph of a girl, the only widow in her high school, after she has decided to turn herself into a tree? It was a rainy afternoon, and her van skidded at 60. For a split second, the trunk of an oak had never seemed so solemn as it did then, widening before her. Or is it misfortune itself? Or the little grimace the woman makes with her mouth above the cane? There, then not there, then there again. Or is it the place where all the comparisons, the little comforts, like the cane she's leaning on, give way beneath us? What do you do when nothing calls you anymore? When you turn and there is only the light filling the empty window? When the angel fasting inside you has grown so thin it flies out of you a last time without your knowing it, and the water dries up in its thimble, and the one swing in the cage comes to rest after its almost imperceptible, almost endless swaying. I'm going to stare at the whirled grain of wood in this desk I'm bent over until it's infinite. I'm going to make it talk. I'm going to make it confess everything. I was about to ask you if you were cold, if you wanted a sweater, because, well, as Stavros would say, before he began one of those stories that seemed endless, the sun pressing against the windows of the cafe and glinting off the stalled traffic just beyond them, this could take a while. I passed the letter I wrote to you over the sleeping cat and beyond the iron grillwork into the irretrievable. I can tell you that when my wife Michelle Poulos and I were in California and she was shooting her documentary about Larry Levis, Late Style Fire, which is now being submitted to film festival competitions around the world, and we were guided to the Café Midi by Larry Levis's ex-wife Barbara, the cafe was all boarded up. And Stavros, he was, of course, long gone. Thank you.